My name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic. Found out about this event called the Gulf Coast Roundup. It's held in Fort Walton Beach in February. And that's where I first heard our speaker tonight, Matt. And I thought, we need to get this guy up to Atlanta. I don't know how the hell they got him down to Fort Walton Beach, because he's from Nashville. You go all the way past Atlanta without stopping by. But anyway, got him to the Marietta Roundup last May. And I've kept in touch with Matt since. And he told me that he's done several other events, and he loves AA in Atlanta because he says people are fired up. And I figured, well, we got to get him to the Rock. And you guys are in for a real treat. And I'm very happy to introduce my friend, Matt.
Hey everybody, my name is Matt. I'm an alcoholic. I got to get up here quick before there's another raffle or something. Get this party started. Thank you. Thank you, Mike, for the introduction, and Wayne, and for the invite to come here. Thank you for the committee, for the past committees. Thank you for all of the hands that it took to make this weekend possible, because I know there's a lot that goes into it. I mean, just, it blows my mind just to think of 400 of us in one place, on one compound, for a whole weekend. And so far, I haven't seen one fight, no tear gas. What's really cool is we're all able to walk in and out of this room on our own free will. That wasn't my experience when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's nothing short of a wholesale miracle. And for that, I'm extremely grateful. Being asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous is a gift, and it's something that I don't take lightly. And so thank you for the opportunity to be here with you all this weekend and to participate in my recovery. My sobriety date is May 1st of 2008. I have a home group in Franklin, Tennessee. Its kickoff isn't until noon. That would be 1 Eastern time. And we meet every Sunday at 8 a.m. We'd love to have you if you're in the area. We meet at the Williamson County Hospital, and it's always humbling for me, and it's a good reminder to just the fatal nature of this disease, because I ended up in a lot of places like ERs and jails and institutions as a result of this disease. And a lot of us, that's our final resting spot, and we don't make it to Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I was sitting through and entertained by the events this evening, waiting to start, what's cool is in sobriety we get to do all types of new things, and I thought my life was over when I first started this journey. But I'd never been to an auction before until tonight, and I think that could count. I think we could check the box. That was pretty cool. And I'm also wondering, like, what's going on here? What are we doing? And then, am I going to get to speak? Maybe they don't want me to speak. But then we got to the countdown, and I got to see my new friend down here with the day stand up, and it takes a lot of guts to stand up. I don't know what I would do if I was at a place like this day one. But you're in for a ride of your life, man. And welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. My mission became clear at that point in time after about an hour of waiting. God sometimes, he he's always on time, but usually never early, and I'm thankful for that. I have a sponsor, and I also have the privilege of taking other guys through the steps as I was taken through the steps, and I truly believe of both sides of sponsorship, and thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a relationship with God today of my limited understanding, but it's all that's needed. And then I had none of that prior to coming to you. But here we are, and you said that, you know, it was suggested to get these things. A sobriety date, that's a good first step. A sponsor, a home group. You know, get plugged in. And so those are my marching orders, and that's what I did. But why would anybody that could drink successfully and have the experience that I had with alcohol put the plug in the jug and be here with a bunch of dudes in North Georgia on a weekend, on a Saturday night of all things? For me, it was the consequences. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in a lot of pain, chasing the effect produced by alcohol that I had at age 12. But before that, I have to tell you just a brief, you know, snapshot of my childhood. It was, and before I even go any further, thank you to the other speakers that have shared, come up here to the podium this weekend. I really enjoyed listening to you, whether it be the workshops or the last night's speaker and everybody else who's performed service at some level. I really have enjoyed it and look forward to our Sunday morning speaker. My childhood was pretty smooth sailing. I had two parents that loved me and would do anything for me. And 3 years after I'd been born, I had a little sister, and she just took a little bit of my thunder, and I had a slight resentment. But overall, you know, it was a great childhood. We moved around a lot. And even though these people loved me with all their ability, I still didn't feel quite part of this family dynamic. I don't remember this, but my mom told me several years ago that I came up to her when I was about three or four years old, dead serious, and said, "Mom, I know that I'm adopted, and I'd like to know where my real family is." And she laughed too, and I can laugh today because I've done the research and they are who they say they are. But it's just these thoughts that I had that were well before, I mean, almost 10 years before my first drink, I had this separation from the people who were closest to me. And that would continue through my early, you know, fundamental years and into elementary school, and started playing sports. Was pretty athletic and had a lot of God-given, I believe, like natural abilities, but I also practiced a lot and became pretty good and was excelling in that part of my life. And me and my best friend, one summer night, it was the summer going into sixth grade, we were in North Carolina. That's pretty much where I grew up. We found his mom's stash of vodka above the washing and dryer machine and poured it off into some bottles like this and put a splash of orange juice in it and ran off into the woods, opened up those bottles and began to just chug it. A couple chugs down, my throat started to close, and I was afraid that I might have gotten some stuff that wasn't really alcohol, that we might have gotten some cleaner or something like that. I might have gotten the wrong batch. The next thing that happened was nothing short of the magic that I'd been looking for my whole life. And I could finally breathe again. And I was finally just laying there in the leaves of this, underneath the tree, just feeling like finally I'm okay. You know, all of the fear, all of that apartness, all of that anxiety that I had was gone, and I'm just laying there, finally just me. That's all I ever wanted. I didn't want all of the, you know, the wreckage that came with several more years of drinking. I didn't want all those consequences. I just wanted to be okay. I just wanted to breathe. And so I would continue to try and live like that. I would continue to try and just breathe. Resources were scarce, as you can imagine, here at 12 years old. We had to continue to steal. And it wasn't until like 13 or 14 we were able to make connections with some older people and continue these activities. But I knew like I had found something in the woods that night, and I would continue to drink to try and recreate those feelings. And each time, each drink would cost a little bit more, and I'd be willing to pay a little bit more for that effect. Now, fast forward, I mean, scarce resources and not a lot of responsibilities, early teens, I was able to go under the radar with consequences. It wasn't until I was able to start driving until things got a little crazy. Went out one night, and I'm sure just like lots of us, when I start to drink, I like to travel. They just go hand in hand. And we were at a pre-party, because now this time I'm still in high school. I'm like maybe a freshman. Got a car because I was really doing well in the sports category, and I was on my way to a Division I school on a full ride as long as I stayed healthy. So my parents, being loving and caring, they bought me my first car, and I took advantage of that opportunity and was just, well, I mean, I didn't think about it. I was taking advantage of it at the time. I just thought I was trying to get from the party to the pre-party to the party, and I had a car full of people. I was not drunk by any means, but I took this two-door car, filled it with five of us, drove right through a stop sign, over an embankment, came crashing down into this person's front yard, and all of a sudden, you know, bags deployed, smoke. I tried to get out, because when I get into a jam, I run. That's just what I do. But the door wasn't able to open, so I had to climb out the window like a NASCAR driver, and I just started running down the road in Durham County. And it was dark out there. It was kind of a suburban area. So I got about 10 feet down, and I couldn't see like my hand in front of me. I turned around. I see smoke coming up from the car, and I didn't even think about anybody else but me. You know, I'd say by the grace of God, you know, nobody was seriously hurt besides some scrapes. And lucky for me, there was another guy who was coming from that same house that we had left, and he saw the whole thing a few ways back, and he pulled up in his station wagon. We all got into his car and went to the party. I knocked a few back. I called home, because this was before cell phones. And I called my mom, and I called my house, and I was like, my mom picked up. I said, Mom, you wouldn't believe what happened. Somebody stole my car. She said, no, the police are here. They told me what happened. You better get back to your car. I was like, okay. Had another one. Doosh, doosh, doosh. Let's go. Show up to the scene. There's two officers there. And they asked me a question. I remember it like it was yesterday. They said, son, how much have you had to drink tonight? And I was like, well, officer, you know, I did not have anything before the accident, but afterwards, I had a beer. And he looked at me and said, son, that's a good answer. And I was like, I know it is. I don't know where it even came from, but it just came out. See, I'm pretty smart when it comes to getting what I need to get, getting around the system, so I think. You know, I can tell people what they need to hear so that I can get what I need to get, so that you get off my back and I can go on about my way. Still continuing to chase that feeling, that release that I had when I was 12 years old. Now driving around, it's not as cute. I got a slap on the wrist that time. I'm still under 18. Fast forward 3 months, my car is totaled, so I borrowed my parents' car one night because these older kids were about to be able to get me into a private club. So I was about to have my first drink out in public, which was a big, you know, that's a big deal for us. And so I had like a shirt picked out. I knew exactly what I was going to order, and I get my parents' car. We could go to the bar, and I ordered two makers and gingers, one, you know, one at a time, but I left that bar. We left with two blondes, and I remember just being able to feel like, you know, perfectly natural talking to them. Before, I was just terrified to talk to women, and especially older women, like 23. They were, these were like, you know, cougars basically at that time. And they were laughing too, and we were, I don't even know what we were laughing about, but we just had a good old time, and we were leaving the bar to go to get some party favors to keep the party going. And I saw flashlights in the side mirror when I was at a stop sign. If you've ever seen those, it's usually not a good thing. Police asked me to pull over. Apparently, I didn't pull over where they wanted me to pull over. I went a little further, and long story short, you know, I ended up in jail, my first DUI that night. And I'll tell you one thing, my first impressions of jail were, this is not a really nice place. Not one that I wanted to stay for any longer than I had to, so I picked up the phone, and I do what I do when I get into trouble, I call home. My dad picked up the phone. This time it's like 3 o'clock in the morning. I was like, Dad, you won't believe what happened. And he's like, I'm sleeping, click. And that was that. But I got bailed out the next day, and my plan was, now I need to figure out who's going to drive me around. Like, that was it. I need to figure out logistics. That was my only problem. And so I continued to do what I did, but now I didn't have a car, so I had to get more creative. But as a result of that, 17 years old, I had to go and take an assessment. And I don't know if you guys have ever had to take one of these things, but it's basically a standardized test for your partying behavior. And you go to a place, and I sat across the table, but I'm a smart guy, so I'm going to pass the test. Well, I failed it. Or I passed it, depending on which side you're on. But they ordered me as a result to go to the A&A. And I'm like, what's the A&A? And they're like, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm like, well, all right, whatever. I'm going to do what I need to do to get what I need to get on down the road and continue on partying, doing what I like. So I walk into my first AA meeting. I'm 17 years old, church basement, open the door, and big plume of smoke comes out, hits me in the face. I thought the church might have been on fire for a second, but there's people inside, and they seem to be having a good time and laughing and stuff. So I walk in, and sure enough, there are in there. I get a little bit closer, and I start to make out their faces. And now, these people are old. And not just like, not just old, but like tales from the crypt. Like, they've been in there, and I don't know how long they've been in this meeting, but they were old. Wow. So I just walk in. I'm like, I got to do the A&A. I got to do this thing. And they said, oh, okay, well, welcome. Glad you're here. And I was like, yeah, I'm glad you're here. And they're really nice, though. Just like, you know, grandma and grandpa, you know, they're very, like, you just keep coming back. And it's like, you know, I'll see you in about 50 years. You just stay off the road. Glad this is working for you. See, I had no conception about what alcoholism was. Somewhere in those years, though, I crossed that invisible line where it talks about in our book of a defense. And I thought that I was the one that was controlling taking the drink. What I didn't realize is that I'd already developed this disease. Whether I was born with it or not, it doesn't really matter. The fact is that I was a full-blown alcoholic, suffering from a fatal illness that gets worse, never better. And that's my story. It got worse, never better. From that point on, I had enough evidence that we could say, okay, you know what, just check the boxes, let's, you know, go on, and maybe we should not drink. And I'm sure that was suggested by some people. But going back just a few, before I even started driving, I believe I went to a psychiatrist because I was getting in trouble in school. And I'll never forget this too. My, you know, you meet with your mom, my mom, one, and the psychiatrist one, and then we went, met with him one-on-one. He asked me some questions. I told like half the partial truth. You know, I didn't want to give it away too much. And we went back with my mom, and then he tells me and my mom, or he's talking to her, you know, your son is drinking and doing these other things because this is just the way he feels normal. He's self-medicating. And I was like, this guy is a genius. Like, that's exactly what I'm doing. And now I have, you know, basically a professional that's given me permission to do it. So I would use that subconsciously. It's like, look, I'm just this is the way I feel normal. And truthfully, I mean, you know, I felt normal for about 3 drinks. But then the physical allergy kicked in, and I lost the choice of the 4 and 5 and 6 and into oblivion. And I was a blackout drinker. A lot of my story, I don't actually remember, so I'm not going to share it from a podium. For all I know, it's hearsay. And this was before the smartphone, you know, thank God. Nobody could tell me otherwise. That it's just, I'd have already blocked it out of my mind, you know. But there were some things that I'm not proud of, you know. I started to, at that point in time, started to make decisions that were against the principles and the values that I grew up with. I knew better. But I was still doing things almost against like my own will. Nobody was holding a gun in my head. But I was an alcoholic whose only solution was alcohol. So it's driving the show. I think I'm driving, but really, you know, King Alcohol is calling the shots. And it was just, what could I do to continue this party going? So after my experience with AA, you know, slapped on the wrist, I got in some more trouble and they shipped me off to boarding school. I went to a boarding school for a year. I got more, you know, exposure to things outside the scope of AA than I had when I was still in public school. Came back to public school. That didn't work. Then I get shipped off to my dad had taken a new job out in the mountains of North Carolina, so that, you know, we tried the old geographical change, and I'm sure you guys know how that went. I found exactly what I was looking for. It was just better quality, and instead of drinking, you know, whiskey, I got turned on to moonshine, and this is a much more economical way to get loaded. Now I'm able to work with the local farmers, you know, the local, you know, produce, you know, support the local economy and local bootleggers, and also too, you know, save a lot. I didn't have to drink as much of that stuff. Now, at this time, like, I hadn't been able to even finish high school because that requires you to show up, and I'd stopped like being able to show up for life. You know, I'd just piss away the soccer, you know, scholarships. Now I'm just living to drink and drinking to live. 17 years old. I'm making money, though, so it's kind of on the outside. I'm like one of these like big pine trees out here. I remember the pine trees when I was growing up, too. Like, they're massive. It's great to be back in some pines. But you can take off that bark sometimes and see, like, there's a worm or something up underneath it. But on the outside, I look great. But inside, I'm already dying. I'm like half dead, 17 years old. But I'm making money, and I'm thinking that this is what it's about. Because as long as I have enough money, I can get you off my back and continue to do what I want to do. So in the winter times, we go snowboarding. And in summer times, spring, summer months, we do these longboards. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but basically a skateboard that's a little bit longer and fun. They just like rip down these hills out there in the mountains. And one night, I was skating with my roommate, and I wasn't like blackout drunk or anything. I had a couple in me, you know. I was feeling pretty loose, and I tried this new run, and I don't remember what happened, but I was flying down the hill way faster than I had intended to be, and went head to concrete. Was pronounced dead on arrival, posturing and not looking really good. Thankfully, he saw it from a distance and was able to call 911, and they picked me up off the ground and rushed me to the hospital. And I can't even imagine, I can't even begin to imagine what that must have been like for my parents, who probably were already expecting a phone call one of these days. But they got it that night, and now they have to go to the hospital. And the neurosurgeons there on call said, you know, we don't know what's going to happen here. So they induced me into a coma and said they give 72 hours, and that's it. He may come out of it, he may not. And they did what they did, and they showed me how to do it my whole life, and they prayed. They prayed God's will on the situation, and they waited. And a few 24 hours later, the neurosurgeon came back and like something miraculous happened. The brain went all the way from over here to practically dead center. We can't explain it medically, like how this happened. And they continued to pray, and it would be several months of me being in like a hospital and then a rehab hospital. I don't remember much of this part of my life. I do remember getting released. Once I was discharged, my roommate picked me up and passed me a flask and one of those medicinal cigarettes that weren't quite legal at that point in time. And without a blink of an eye, I don't have choice. See, I thought the first step meant that I was powerless over alcohol, my life had become unmanageable, that I can never drink again, which sounded extremely depressing, one. It's true, I've lost the ability to drink successfully. But it also, what it means to me today is that I don't have the power not to take the first drink. In and of myself, I will drink again. So it's not a surprise to you, I'm sure. But to everyone else, and even to me, it's like, you know, it's pretty selfish to just continue on down this path. But this is the only path that I knew, and I was willing to take it all the way to the end. But two reasons to tell that story. One, because from that point on, with the introduction to high-powered sedatives and opiates and that stuff that I was medically given for a good reason, and then mixing that with alcohol, it propelled me into some of the darkest years of my life. From the time I was 19 until what I pray to be my last drink at 23. The other reason I tell that story is because to this day I've never thought about getting on a skateboard. I'm what our book calls a problem skateboarder. Or a hard skateboarder. And with sufficient reason, I can just step away. I didn't think, well, maybe if I'd have gotten some bigger wheels or if I'd have just, you know, it should have not been going that fast. You know, I didn't have to rationalize, justify, or try to defend skateboard. I just don't do it. It's like, yeah, you can skateboard. That's cool. I didn't need a spiritual awakening to not get back on the skateboard. With alcohol, it's a different game. Because this thing talks to me. It tells me things like, you know what, it's going to be different. Or, you know what, screw it. And I don't have the defense. Without a power greater than me, like I will drink again. And I'm convinced of that today. So I tried geographical changes. I tried changing from light to dark liquor. I tried all of that stuff too, just like you guys, just like the book talks about. The last thing I hadn't tried was a relationship. Because I was like, that might work. So I'm hanging out with these guys. We're not a real real happy bunch. We kind of like vampires. We stay up real late, don't see us much during the day, and I'm quite content. You know, I'm just kind of doing me. And then I came across this girl. She just got out of prison. And so I felt like I could trust her. All right? Makes sense. I was living on the dark side. She's living in the dark side. We can, you know, we can do this thing together. And we latched on two ticks on one dog, and it was not pretty. But man, we were gonna do it, you know, it turned into a pretty toxic relationship, as you can imagine. She had two kids, and there's just a lot of stuff that I'm not going to unpack here from the podium, but like I'll just say, I didn't help her to be a better person, and she wasn't necessarily helping me become a better person through this process, but we were just doing what we do, and through the process of us running together, we started getting into some trouble, more so than the slaps on the wrist, and you know, we went right by misdemeanors at about, you know, Mach 2 and started continuing to party. Like, we wanted to, you know, keep the party going. And I don't know about you, but something changed in me. Not so much when I was drinking. Yeah, all bets are off. I don't know what's going to happen, where I'm going to end up, you know, all of that. But between drinks is when things got really crazy. The things that I was willing to do, the thoughts that were coming to me, that mental obsession of what I have to do to get to the next one. And I started to just do things that were against, like I said, all of those values and all of the principles that I had grown up with. And the next drink cost me more and more until I didn't feel like I had much left to give. And I'd start going into places that I couldn't get out of, like hospitals and treatment centers. I thought I was pretty smart because if you had if the law was looking for you, you could go check yourself in voluntarily to a hospital and they wouldn't be able to tell the law that you were there. So I'd go out there and, you know, catch some charges they'd be looking for me. I'd go check into the hospital and I'd come up with a plan. Like this happened continually. Like this was just my pattern and spree and remorse, just like it talks about. Well, keep ending up in places like this, and you people keep showing up, like AA meetings and stuff. And I'm like, what? I've already been to AA. I know this is just for old people, and, you know, like, you've got nothing to offer me. But I just, like, you're so nice, I just would listen. And I don't remember much of anything you'd say, but you're always nice and always very welcoming. And, I'm going to just jump right into it. You, like what's already been shared this weekend, you keep showing up in front of the judge like time and time again. They get tired of seeing you, and the consequences continue to get worse and worse. And we'd get in trouble, get bailed out. She'd get in trouble, I'd bail her out. Well, this last time, I'd bailed her out, and we started running, and we started a spree that lasted, I don't know, 3 weeks maybe, a couple states, and I ended up going home. I crossed every line that was possible to cross besides, you know, an ultimate one. And my plan was to go home, say goodbye to my mom, get a change of clothes, and get out of the country. That's the plan. I got into, my parents lived in this gated community at the time. Punched in. My mom hadn't heard from me in a long time. She's excited, opens the gate. I come into the community, driving in there, and all of a sudden I see this undercover at the bottom of the hill. But it's a mountain road, so I couldn't really turn around or do anything crazy, otherwise I'd drive off the mountain. And I just play it cool. That's me, I'm Joe Cool. I'm going to just try to talk my way out of this one, but they weren't hearing it. And I ended up in the back of his car and looking back behind us at my car, and there was a dog in my car that wasn't my dog. and then within a moment, like within a few minutes, like there, the whole street was lined with these detectives and undercovers. And then here, a few minutes pass, and my mom is driving. She's like wondering where we are, so she comes and I see her talking to one of them. And then she drives by, and I see the look in her eyes. And the only thing that I can relate it to is a mother that's standing over her son's casket. She was just like pale white and distraught. And something in me snapped at that point in time. And I don't know if this was cried out loud or just in my deepest, my soul, but I said, God, I can't live like this anymore. Please help me. I'm willing to do whatever it takes. And almost instantly, the first thing that came to my mind were those people in AA. So I've been around you guys long enough to know that there was something happening in there, happening in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I'd love to tell you that, like, you know, I got out on bail that day and was able to go home and go to my home group and retake my position, but that just wasn't the case. Because we also talk about, you know, making amends here. And what ended up happening was I got taken to a federal detention facility and facing 929 months for a series of things that had happened over the last 3 years, but primarily those things that I said I did in the last 2 weeks. And that, talk about the flood tides coming in, like, by the grace of God, and for reasons I can only explain as love, like, my parents found the money to get me a decent lawyer, and the lawyer was like, well, the best we're looking at is habitual, and that's a 7 to 11. And that looked better than 929, but still, same time this is all happening, I'm still locked up, and my dad gets diagnosed with this rare form of cancer that's given him 18 months to live at best. So there's a lot of things spinning around my head my first week of sobriety. But I just kept, you know, staying in today the best I could. I didn't really have anything else to do. But I remember it being like just like a haze. And I get to, once I get to a floor, like once I get through processing and stuff, I get... you know, the AA call. So I go and I go to those AA meetings again. Because I know, remember the prayer in the car? I was like, all right, you know, this is what I got to do. And I don't remember anything that guy said. I don't remember a word. Except for that he was there when he said he was going to be. And at the end of the meeting, he got in the elevator and went down and went home to his family or his dog or whatever. And I went back to my world, which was, you know, about the size of a closet. And that was attractive. That was an attractive message. So for those of us who are going into the correctional facilities, it's not always what you say that matters. It's being there. That holds a lot of weight. It did for me. And as I get through the process, you know, it's getting closer and closer to my date where I go to court. And I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I'm facing a lot of time, and I'm just meditating over some spiritual literature, and trying to truly just, like, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm just going to surrender. And as it turned out, you know, my lawyer had a day in court, and I was able to work out like a plea with a lot of probation, suspended. A lot of time spent with the suspended sentence, and just did 10 to 12 months back to back in the state prison, which wasn't really fun at all. It was a lot better than the alternative. I feel like there's a lot of grace there, and that's where I got sober. That's where, at 23 years old, I walk into, you know, a maximum security prison, and it's not a pretty place. I've seen things and heard things, and I wish I didn't, and I can't forget. But that, you know, that's just the nature of that environment. And thankfully, I just kind of kept my head down and got moved to a medium security prison within a few weeks. Didn't have to stay there too long. And that was not like, you know, rainbows, you know, and picket fences either. But I was able to get plugged in, and I found, that's where I found my first sponsor. But everything on state is like really complex. Like, you had to, they tell you when you got there, they're like, you know, you want to go to work or do you want to go to school? And I said, well, I want to go to work. I need some money. And they said, you can't go to work. You got to go to school. So I'm like, all right. Well, what classes do you have available? And like, well, they got this baking class, and they got, you know, horticulture. They got masonry class. I was like, well, I'm pretty hungry right now. I like, let me get that cooking class. And they said, sorry, that class is full. And it's just like, you know, that kind of stuff over and over again. And I was like, all right, well, I'll do the horticulture class. Okay. Well, I knew a little something about growing closet tomatoes back in the day, so I figured I could teach them something. Little did I know that they were about to teach me that I was about to experience, you know, a lesson of spiritual significance. Because I got to see, you know, just my part in this whole thing. When I plant a seed in the soil, I don't actually make that thing grow. Like, I don't pull anything out. As far as I know, like, humans don't pull the little leaves out of the seed. Something bigger than us does. And this started to mold my conception of God in that, like, I have some work that I can do for this relationship. It's like making sure the soil is, you know, not rocky, and, you know, making sure that there's no weeds in the soil, and aerating it, putting seed in there, putting some water on it, little things like this. But I don't actually do the growing. And it was in that class, too, I learned that I'm not as stupid as I thought I was. Because I tried community college 5 times. But each time I'd find a new prospect and would just stop going. But I found that if you go to class, which they helped, you know, I got pretty good grades. Now, it's also where I met my sponsor. My first sponsor, his name is Terry. And Terry was like, you know, he was just like me, except he was nothing like me. On paper, he came from another part of the state. He was doing, 50, like, I think he was already doing 10 on a 15, similar charges. And, you know, he looked totally different on paper, but he was carrying himself with some type of something that was attractive. Yeah, and I saw him at those meetings that I had signed up to go to. And Terry was, you know, he was a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Terry had a sponsor. His sponsor was an outside guy. So I asked Terry to be my sponsor. It was terrifying. Asking another man for help, I mean, talk about getting out of your comfort zone. But that's where this thing started. And just like it talks about in the forward to the third edition, you know, recovery begins, you know, every day, everywhere, you know, where one alcoholic sits with another, just sharing their experience, strength, and hope. And that's exactly what happened. And we're sitting out on the yard every weekend. Terry would read and I would listen. We'd open up this big book. And he would read and I would listen. I said, Terry, you know I know how to read. He said, Matt, and as loving as Terry could say, he's like, you know what? You do better if you just listen. Take the cotton out of your ears, put it in your mouth. And so I did that. And we got through the steps. And as we get to step two, you know, I had a lot of these conceptions from my upbringing about God. And he said, Matt, I'm not going to say any of this stuff is wrong. Do me a favor. Do yourself a favor. Let's put your ideas of what God is on the back burner. Let's go through the steps and let's try to have a new experience. What a beautiful thing. What a beautiful thing. He wasn't discounting anything that I knew or any of my previous experiences, what I call God or anything like that. He just helped me to put that aside. And it is truly, I got to see in this facility, my first home group was the Inside Freedom group. And I got to see one of the miracles, I believe, in Alcoholics Anonymous is what Ebby said to Bill when Bill was pushing back against his, you know, he's got religion. And Ebby said, you know, why don't you come up with your own conception? However limited it may be, that's enough for a beginning. And in this particular group, I got to sit around and recover with Buddhists, with atheists, with Muslims, with guys who would not mix. We weren't even mixing out on the yard, but we're in Alcoholics Anonymous, holding hands, going around, you know, the circle. That if that's not a demonstration of a power greater than myself, I don't know what is. So I'm very sensitive. I respect that we all are coming in here with on different paths and with different conceptions. What a beautiful thing. As we get through the steps, we get to step. I do my first four step. There's some stuff in there that I'm surely not going to tell another inmate. I'm not even sure if I'm going to tell another soul yet. But I'm not even going to write it down because I'm not stupid. You know, I'm just started a bid and I'm not trying to stay for any longer than I have to. So I tell Terry this. He says, no problem. As soon as you have the opportunity to share this with somebody, do it. Yes, sir. Do my fifth step. We go on and once we get through 6 and 7 and get to 8, I made a list of all the people who I had harmed. And next to the list, we went through it and Terry would say, now, you need to make this amends. Now meant when I got out. Later meant later after I got out. Never meant don't talk to that person. You got no business going back and trying to make amends to, oh, what's her name, or Bonnie, or anybody. Stay away. I said, okay, that works. And right as we were finishing that 8-step list, I got shipped to another facility. And that facility, they knew I was coming. AA knew I was coming. I already had a sponsor by the time the bus like put the brakes on, because we get the message through the walls, and they had they didn't have me the guy that I really wanted, but they had me one of his sponsees, and his name was Juan, and Juan was a great member of AA too, and we went through the first 8 steps just like Terry and I did, but when we got to 8, Juan said, "Now means now. You need to get a piece of paper and a pencil and start writing some letters to these people. Or if they're not going to come in, you're going to be able to make a direct amends in person." So I said, okay, how do you do that? He's like, well, the directions are in the book, black ink. You know, he was real helpful with that. He even underlined it together. So I knew what my marching orders were on my amends, you know, my amends letter. And it really helped me, even before I made a face-to-face amends, to write out my amends. Because this isn't a monologue of, you know, woe is me, or I'm sorry. Because people knew I was sorry. I was written off as just a sorry, you know, what? But this is much more of a, you know, a outline in the facts. Facts are, this is what I did to hurt you. My life depends on me trying to set things right. What can I do right now? He made me add that, like, because it's an important time. To set things right. What can I do to set right the wrong? And I think it was pretty simple. And I started at the top of the list. Top of the list was my mom, because she wasn't going to come in to visit. My dad was. He would later. And so I wrote my mom a letter, and I said, you know, I don't know. I've done everything besides physically hurt you. I don't know what I can do. I haven't been a good son. Let me know what I can do to make this right now. And send off the letter. I don't remember, you know, how long it was until I got a reply, but I did one day, and I opened it up. I'm sat there and said, you know, Matt, the only thing we want from you is for you to love yourself like we've loved you this whole time. And man, I just broke down. floodgates opened, my tear ducts were flowing. And I could have handled like $5,000 a lot better than that. Just for me to love me like they've been loving me this whole time. And I was like, okay, well, what do I do with this? She's like, well, you're starting it already. You're starting to do that by continuing on this path, continuing through the steps. We're going to get in, you know, let's continue on. But he's like, also try to go and maybe spend a day out of the month whenever you do get home. Spend a day out of the month to just spend time with your mom. Taking a step back, when I was at the facility with Terry earlier, I had an inkling for a big book. I didn't want to ask my parents for anything because I'd already burned those bridges and I felt real guilty for what they had already done. And I said, I don't know what to do, Terry. And he said, well, there's an address in the back of the big book. Why don't you write 459? So I was like, okay, I didn't have anything else going on. So I just wrote a letter up to central office, or GSO, excuse me. I sent a letter out there and forgot I even sent it. A couple weeks later, I get called down to the mailroom, and there's a box there from general service office. In that box, too, there's a letter addressed to me specifically. And it says, Dear Matt, your recent letter has come to me as I'm currently serving on the corrections assignment here at General Service Office. My name is Gail and I'm an alcoholic. It's good to have this opportunity to be in touch. Sounds like you paid a high price for your drinking, and I'm glad to know you're turning to Alcoholics Anonymous for help. See, at this point, I thought AA was just confined into this to my meeting here in this facility, but I realized that there's a much bigger world of Alcoholics Anonymous outside of here. There's another woman, her name's Gail. She's in New York right now. She's thinking about me. She cares about me. My world got bigger that day. And I get on down the road and I get close to getting home. My dad, he'd come in, I was able to make direct amends. We were able to be whole. It's time to go home now. And I got a sponsor in my last facility. His name was Bob. And Bob said he goes to prison so he doesn't go to prison. I said, that's fascinating. Tell me more. And Bob is another awesome member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's been going to that prison for over 20 years. And he was able to take me through the work in the sheriff's office. They let him have the room on the weekends, and so we got to meet one on one. And he was still such an instrumental person in my life, just like so many people, some in this room. And I said, "What do I do when I get out?" And he's like, "Well, you know, you're gonna continue to practice these principles, and you're going to go and you're going to get a home group. You're going to find people to sponsor. You're going to get a commitment." He was really big on commitments. So like, all right, let's do that. And I was really thankful to find, because by the time I had gotten out, my parents had moved from North Carolina to Tennessee. I was really happy that they had AA in Tennessee. Even better is that Bob knew a guy that knew a guy who lived in Tennessee. So now I'm thinking that AA is like the mob, and you guys are like, yeah, everywhere. And it's kind of like that, but... So Scott was the guy who was put on my path from Bob in North Carolina through Tom I, who also was part of this story. And when I got to Tennessee, I knew my mom, my dad, and I had this guy, Scott's number. I go and I meet Scott at 5925 backroom group, his home group. And I'm still kind of just a little shell-shocked, a little bit. Just people walking in and out of the rooms and stuff, kind of, it's weird. But I go to meet this guy, and I go to give him, you know, and embrace him with a hug, you know, give him a little pat on the back, and right there, like, I realized he wasn't letting go. Like, he was giving me a hug, like a real hug, that I hadn't had in a long, long time. So my immediate reaction was like, I'm going to freak out. Do I need to hit this guy or what? It's going to happen. But then the second thought was surrender. And I just melted. I melted in his arms. And I let him give me a proper hug. And he's my sponsor today. We have a great relationship. He pulled me into Alcoholics Anonymous. I get plugged in my home group at the time. I need to get a service commitment. So I asked Bob, I was like, how do you do that? And he's like, find somebody in the group that looks like they've been around, one of the old timers, tell them you need to get involved in service. So I find Detroit Dave sitting over there. I was like, Dave, you know, I need to get involved in service. He starts laughing at me. And I'm like, I don't know what's so funny here. Like, he's like, you want to get involved in service? Okay, come to the business meeting. Like, all right. The heck's so funny. But I show up to the business meeting and I leave the GSR. didn't know what a GSR is. It's, for those of you who don't, it's a group service representative. It's a great honor to be you represent the group at higher levels. And I got a pamphlet, so I studied it. You know, it was a quick study. I needed to make sure I got it done right. And I had this strange desire to go back into correctional facilities. Most people just got out of prison do not want to go back. Voluntarily. But I was like, something had happened through the process of my time there. Like, I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to think, we tell our stories, we say in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And what happened was facing 929 months, being in the back of the car, all of those things. That's what I thought what happened was. But what happened was I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I fell in love with the man that I become as a result of practicing these principles and following in your footsteps. And so, as a GSR, I was, they gave me money to go to an assembly, which is like in Tennessee at least, we have one area assembly, like the entire state. So I show up, I'm like 3 months out of prison. I show up, I'm still like having trouble talking in public. I don't know if anybody else had that issue, but I was very it passed. As you can see, I feel a little better now. And the thing is I showed up to this assembly, and I went to the corrections committee, and I said, my name's Matt, I just got out, I want to be involved in corrections. And they were like, well, we're glad you're here. It's like, can I, they weren't going to give me too much responsibility until the next assembly when they nominated me as treasurer. And I'm like, guys, did you remember what I said? Like, where I just came from? And so anyways, I had the opportunity to serve as the area treasurer for the corrections committee. And that kind of stuff just doesn't happen for guys like me. For the same guy that used to say that the old man will drink again, and the same man that walked into Alcoholics Anonymous will drink again. But through the process of taking the steps, the transformation has taken place. And I'm no longer that man. As a result of that, the promise in the 12th step, as a result of the steps, a spiritual awakening has taken place. I'm no longer fighting a drink today. That obsession has been removed. And what an incredible gift. I hope I never forget that. And after that process of getting plugged into the corrections committee at the area level, I was able to go in and start taking meetings to a local jail. Held that commitment for several years. I've been able to speak at a lot of the prisons that I used to live in. I went back to the one I met Bob at, and both of us got to go in together. What an awesome opportunity. We got to leave together, which is even better. Like, that's the magic right there. That's the miracle of this thing. And you know what? I've gotten to do a little traveling. I just started like 30 minutes ago. But the gifts that I receive are far, far more than anything I could have ever imagined or planned for. I mean, I left prison with the goal of going back to community college to get a degree because of that thing that happened in a horticulture class. Well, I did that, and eventually, like, I got kicked out of community college with an associate's degree, and went on and got a bachelor's, and then they kicked me out with a bachelor's degree, and I went to get a master's, and several things like that have continued to happen that I didn't plan. All I did was I suited up and I showed up and trust the outcomes to a loving God who, like I said, I'm not fully capable of even understanding, and that's okay. God doesn't need me to understand God. God just needs me to stay in today so that I don't miss those miracles that are all around me and that keep me grounded and keep me in a place to be of service. Because when I'm in service to you, I'm not thinking about me. And that is just another one of the many miracles that I get to see today. So, good meetings start on time. Great meetings end on time. I love you all with all my heart. Thank you.